Welcome to The Dig, a podcast from Jacobin Magazine. My name is Daniel Denver, and I'm broadcasting from Providence, Rhode Island. Today's Friday Dig, or Diglet, is really not that diminutive at all. I have two interviews with two separate guests because too much has happened over the past few weeks, and there are too many smart people to analyze it all. First up is Marisol Lebrón, a professor of American Studies at Dickinson College. She is currently working on her first book, Policing Life and Death, Race, Violence, and Resistance in Puerto Rico, which examines the growth of punitive governance in contemporary Puerto Rico. Marisol is also one of the founders of the Puerto Rico Syllabus, a digital project about the Puerto Rican debt crisis. We're going to talk about how Hurricane Maria was, for Puerto Rico, a doubly man-made disaster. Not only has climate change supercharged storms, but the long history of U.S. colonialism and, more recently, the brutal imposition of austerity has also made those storms more dangerous to Puerto Rico because Puerto Rico's infrastructure has been decimated. Then I've got Brandi Jensen, who you might know from the internet. She lives in Brooklyn with her dog and tweets too much, but the Baffler pays her to do so. We're going to discuss the past week of Republican grotesquery, including Trump's attack on black NFL players and right-wing Christian supremacist Roy Moore's Senate primary victory in Alabama. Oh, I almost forgot. We have at least 114 new supporters on Patreon.com this month. Our goal is to get to 125 before October happens. And so we need 11 listeners before October 1st to get there. Please hook us up and go to patreon.com/thedig and make a donation before midnight on Saturday. That's patreon.com/thedig. If you haven't contributed yet, press pause and give something now. I put a lot of time into these shows, and so does my producer, Alex Lewis. We're getting to the point where these shows are financially sustainable for us. And once we get past that point, we plan on making a major investment to improve the audio quality of our guests. But that costs money. To the nearly 500 listeners who have contributed already, thank you. And on to the show. Marisol Lebrón, welcome to The Dig.
Thanks for having me.
Before we get into the context, explain what the situation is right now in Puerto Rico.
I mean, I think the key thing to know is that Puerto Rico is in the midst of a deep humanitarian crisis. The entire territory remains without electricity. The estimate is that it's going to take about 4 to 6 months to fully reestablish electrical power throughout the territory. We are talking about situations in which people are living with sewage in the streets and in their homes, still with floodwaters in their home. I was reading a report this morning by the Center for Investigative Journalism in Puerto Rico that is just estimating that the death toll that the government is giving us is incomplete, mostly because communication is still down throughout the territory. So we haven't even begun to really know the effects of what's happening there.
And do you have family there?
I do. I have a lot of family there. My father's there, stepmom, brother and sister, grandparents, cousins, aunts, the whole deal. And I've been able to hear secondhand about, you know, my grandma and some aunts and cousins, but have not been able to make contact with my dad and stepmom and siblings or my grandfather. So it's very stressful. I think a lot of folks in the diaspora are feeling really helpless and trying to figure out how to deal with this. And you know, I think a lot of folks like myself and others are trying to figure out how to at least be productive in this period of limbo that we're all kind of in until we hear from our family. So I've been really struck and amazed by the organizing efforts happening throughout the diaspora to raise awareness about the situation in Puerto Rico and to also get vital materials and funds into Puerto Rico.
Let's turn to the why. Puerto Rico has been under a brutal austerity regime in recent years that has made the impact of the hurricane much worse. First, if you could explain the origins of the debt crisis and then how it led to the current austerity regime.
Yeah, so I think, you know, that is the key thing to know is that a lot of folks are focusing on kind of Irma and Maria and the immediate impact, but really the devastation that Irma and Maria were able to inflict in Puerto Rico is really because of these austerity measures that have been in place definitely since 2008, but really precede that in terms of a general kind of neoliberal trend and continued kind of colonial neglect towards Puerto Rico, the effects of these hurricanes are just so much more magnified than they would have been had these austerity measures not been in place. So I think in terms of the roots of the debt crisis, it's really important to think with a kind of long historical view about the debt crisis. So obviously in 2008, we get a kind of global recession and Puerto Rico is hit very deeply. And it's very easy to pinpoint how, you know, what Juan Gonzalez calls this kind of death spiral of debt really starts to kind of pick up after 2008. But Puerto Rico had already been in a longstanding recession long before that, for years before that. And really, Puerto Rico, since it became a U.S. Colony, U.S. territory, has just been periodically hit by economic crises after economic crises that have not, the root causes of those crises are endemic to the form of colonial capitalism that Puerto Rico is under. So we can think about 1898 even as a key moment of talking about the debt crisis, and then also 1952 with the establishment of the Commonwealth in 1952, we really start to see a kind of inflation of the Puerto Rican economy that's based on industrialized exports, that's based on tax breaks, the very same kind of tax breaks for American companies that we're seeing, the privileging of American industry on the island that we're continuing to see, and that really have led to the debt crisis. And so, you know, along with the Commonwealth, we have what's known as Operation Bootstrap established, which is dubbed this industrialization by invitation method of kind of, you know, supposedly modernizing the Puerto Rican economy, getting it away from its agricultural base. And that kind of bubble that Operation Bootstrap creates of, you know, there are kind of measurable increases in living standards, but that boom that it creates really is kind of enabled by the massive population exodus to the mainland United States and through all of these kind of shady kind of tax breaks and regulations that kind of mask the inability of the Puerto Rican economy to really provide for all of its citizens. And so following the kind of collapse of that Operation Bootstrap model, this showing as soon as the 1960s, really in the 1970s, in a deep crisis where that model is no longer working, we really just see Puerto Rico in these kind of boom and bust cycles where the government is unable to address the ways in which this colonial relationship is perpetuating these kind of economic crises.
And how ultimately, in the lead up to the recent financial crisis and economic crash, how does that lead to massive debt?
Yeah, I think that we see that the Puerto Rican government gets itself into a situation where it is borrowing and borrowing and borrowing for necessary infrastructural upkeep. You know, there are claims of financial malfeasance, right, and corruption that also definitely play a role in terms of how the borrowing was done, why Puerto Rico agreed to such usurious terms on many of these loans. And So we really see that Puerto Rico is functioning and able to keep the economy running through debt, right? So in many ways, what happened in Puerto Rico, we see it mirrored in various places, right? And that's what we really see come to light after the 2008 financial crisis, is the way in which this debt economy, that it's part and parcel of neoliberal economics, really put prime these countries for deep recession and crisis, and also prime them for kind of further austerity measures. I think the thing to also think about in the context of Maria and how it relates to the debt crisis is that we're seeing these same Wall Street hedge funds worried about what Maria means for their ability to recoup their losses, right, or to make exponential profits on these junk bonds, essentially, that they had invested in and picked up for pennies on the dollar. And so what we're seeing is them doing two things, right, which is, one, pressuring the Trump administration and the U.S. federal government not to place a moratorium on the debt. So Puerto Rico is currently in Title III kind of bankruptcy hearings right now. And there's a question, they're supposed to have a hearing in about 2 weeks, whether that hearing is going to happen, right? And what the debt payment structure is going to be, considering the devastation of these two hurricanes. And you see a steady and concerted effort by these hedge funds and really Wall Street vultures to prevent any kind of hold or to a resistance to accepting, you know, what's called like a haircut, right? So only getting a portion of their funds back, right, of the debt repaid or having to take losses on the debt. So that's one thing that folks are worried about. And then also this kind of resistance to even auditing the debt in the first place, huh, right? Yeah. So a main request out of Puerto Rican civil society since the installation of the Fiscal Control Board and the imposition of the PROMESA Act is, what the hell is the $72 billion of debt, right? And no one can answer that, because there has been a concerted effort both at the local and the federal level to shut down any kind of auditing of the debt. And the reason why many Puerto Rican activists believe that, and economists as well, right, believe that there is such a resistance to auditing the debt, is that it will show that the majority of the debt was illegally generated and would be dismissed, especially now that Puerto Rico has entered into these Title III, this Title III process, right? And so we're seeing intense lobbying not to issue a moratorium. We're seeing an intense lobbying not to audit the debt. And then on top of that, these Wall Street firms are offering Puerto Rico more debt. So we're seeing them say, we'll give you a really good rate right now to help you get out of this crisis, right? Because I think that the reality is the Trump administration is not going to give Puerto Rico the kind of federal aid that it's entitled to in order to rebuild.
So just to recap the current history, you have a development model that's basically financed by debt in a way that benefits finance. And then there's an economic crisis caused by finance, which leads to a debt crisis that allows finance to impose an austerity regime on Puerto Rico.
Right. I mean, the dictates that finance is really, in some ways, driving the car here. And I think that's one of the most frustrating things that folks are trying to figure out, how to plan a recovery when so much of it is outside of their hands.
how did that austerity imposed by big finance set up Puerto Rico for an even worse disaster when Hurricane Maria arrived? And how might that austerity be an obstacle to a just and democratic recovery?
Right. So I think that, you know, one part of it is this kind of colonial mentality, which is really placing the blame on Puerto Ricans. And what that blame is eliding or obscuring is how these austerity measures are really part of what deepened the debt and then made the kind of effects of the hurricane even worse, right? It's not necessarily Puerto Rican incompetence and irresponsibility that does that, right? It's really this imposition of these austerity measures. So an example, kind of the clearest example of how these austerity measures made the effects of Maria and Irma worse, right, is if we think even about Irma. Irma grazed the island. It wasn't a direct impact. And already with that, we had the power grid take a massive hit where people, by the time Maria hit, still hadn't had electricity in various parts of the territory, right? We did have losses of homes and vital infrastructure, even with Irma, right? So that speaks to, you know, how bad the infrastructure already was, which is because since 2008, Puerto Rico has been foregoing necessary improvements to its infrastructure that it has needed for decades in some cases, but definitely within the span of the last 5 years. So even before these kind of catastrophic weather events, we had a couple years ago where the island went completely dark for 3 years because of a fire in one of the electrical plants, right? We had the massive drought in Puerto Rico. That happened when I was there a couple years ago as well, where the island basically had water for about an hour or two a day over the span of weeks. And so these are infrastructural crises that were already problems. I mean, the kind of crisis that was happening in Puerto Rico's hospitals before this happened, where there was not only an issue of the physical spaces of the hospitals, but also personnel, because Puerto Rico's been losing so many doctors and nurses in this massive exodus of the past few years, right? And so once Maria and Irma hit, what we see is that the kind of rubber bands that were holding together what little kind of infrastructure existed on the island got blown away, right, and got drowned out. So the fact that 100% of the island is without steady power and will be for 4 to 6 months, right, is very telling. The fact that 80% of the island still doesn't have steady communication, right, is telling to the state of how the telecommunication infrastructure was on the island, right? Its sewers and aqueducts had needed substantial repair much before, right? And so these were all necessary repairs and infrastructural upgrades that needed to happen before these storms hit, and that could not happen because of these austerity measures, and precisely because the board has not given, since the imposition of PROMESA on the board, they have not allowed these upgrades and improvements to happen because they're trying to force Puerto Rico to privatize these public infrastructural groups, right? So members of the Fiscal Control Board have come out in national kind of newspapers calling for PREPA, for the power authority, to be privatized. It is likely...
Wow, this is really like a shock doctrine style exploitation of the crisis to push for privatization.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's what we have to be very attentive to. And this is, you know, Katrina is really the lesson for, I think, Puerto Ricans moving forward of how to, what to resist, right? What kind of changes to resist and what we have to be, you know, I think there's a feeling of people just want relief. You know, people just want things to go back to normal. And so if privatizing public utilities makes that happen, I think people are going to be willing to consent to that because there is such desperation right now. And I think what we have to be very attentive to is how corporate interests, how the board are going to kind of make those the only options, right? Because they have been pushing those options for a very long time already. I mean, the fights over privatizing public utilities date back decades, intensified during the 90s and during the 2000s under the governorship of Luis Fortunio, where he laid off, he basically gutted the public employment sector, right? He lays off thousands of public sector employees, right? These have all been attempts to really push people's hands into supporting privatization. Most Puerto Ricans have been staunchly opposed to privatization. Privatization attempts have been met with deadly protests in the streets. So in early 1990s, when Pedro Rosselló, the father of the current governor, attempted to privatize the Puerto Rico telephone company, I mean, the people were killed, you know, people were killed and beaten in the streets during these protests. So really, there has been a staunch anti-privatization movement. But I think the fear is that if that is the only option to regain normalcy, then people will feel like they have no other option but to acquiesce to that.
Because now is really the perfect opportunity for them to try to push it through when people are less able to resist because they're just trying to survive. They can't even really get to the negotiating table because they're on the ground with the creditors' boot against their neck. So that's not, it's a perfect moment for them to leverage this crisis.
Absolutely. And I think the other thing is that, you know, it not only is it the perfect moment to do this, right, because people are so desperate, but also, I mean, you have to think about the population decrease, right? There's less people to resist these things, right? People are not going to stick around for 4 to 6 months with no power, no electricity, particularly folks that need medical care, whose careers so are in maybe the tourism sector or other sectors that are not going to be part of recovery efforts, that are not going to be up and running for months, right? And so we have to think of this population decrease as not only kind of managing the crisis in terms of, you know, shipping off surplus populations, but also as really, in a sense, as a safety valve on dissent, right? There's less people, and particularly less people who are going to be the most likely to speak up, they are going to be around and able to do that, right? And so I think that is really key in terms of, and has been throughout Puerto Rico's history, in terms of how Puerto Rico has been able to really manage these kind of moments of political and economic crises and their manifestations is by using migration as a safety valve.
I'd like you to say a little bit more about that. There's potentially a very large-scale exodus right now underway to the mainland, and this is in the context of an already huge migration that has taken place since the imposition of austerity began. Can you explain what the scope of that migration is and how that's impacted Puerto Ricans on and off the island?
Right. I mean, Puerto Rico's essentially been losing hundreds of thousands of residents for the past couple of years as this crisis has deepened. So now there are more people who are Puerto Rican identified living in the United States than there are actually living in Puerto Rico. And this is something that when I was doing the research and follow-up research for my book, talking to people who are in their, you know, teens and 20s, where, you know, they're just pissed, right? They just feel like they want to stay and they are not being given the tools and options to be able to do that, right? And so I think we have to really consider migration in this circumstance as really an act of colonial violence, right, that has made Puerto Rico unlivable, right, for people who want to stay there, right, that is essentially forcing migration. And the thing for us to also think about in terms of that is that folks are leaving, and I think that the attention has and the kind of way that the media has positioned it has been as a brain drain, right? And so it's doctors, the wealthy, the highly educated who are leaving the island, And what we see is that actually the exodus is coming from all economic classes, right? And so what's happening is that, sure, you have engineers and doctors and lawyers who are leaving and able to establish themselves in the U.S., but what we're seeing is that folks from the kind of middle and lower economic brackets are coming and are coming to places like Kissimmee and Orlando and all of these places in Central Florida, also traditional kind of points of Puerto Rican settlement, and they're encountering the same kind of unemployment, or they're stuck in low-wage service sector jobs, right, that are not unionized, with no benefits, that are paying the minimum wage, right? But that's seen for many, particularly after the imposition of the Promesa bill, as kind of an improvement, right? Because Promesa, if you're under 25, you can be paid less than the minimum wage, right? And so the fear for young people and for folks who have already been experiencing exclusion from the formal economy is that they might not be getting the best jobs in the U.S., but it's better than not working, right, or not having access to certain kinds of social safety nets, right? So the ways in which also state benefit or federal benefits are extended to Puerto Rico is highly uneven, right? So people don't have the same access to social welfare in Puerto Rico that they would if they, you know, migrated to Orlando. And so that is key to what many people are making these really difficult decisions about migrating. And I think that that is going to only intensify in the aftermath of Maria, just because the responses has showed from kind of the federal government that this is not going to be an easy process, and it's going to be a very long and kind of arduous process.
One thing about the potential process that has you concerned is that the emphasis on debt repayment will lead to economic growth being prioritized over ordinary Puerto Ricans' basic needs. And that as a result, boosting tourism and rebuilding San Juan in particular will be emphasized.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a central concern for many. And we're seeing that play out even right now with how the relief efforts are kind of happening. And so, for instance, my family is in San Sebastian, which is in the western part of the island. And they're just like completely without communication, right? Whereas folks who are in San Juan are able to get, and other parts of the island are able to get a little bit more access. We're seeing that resources are not making their way into the rural interior, into more isolated areas, and definitely not to the west coast of the island, right, and to southern parts of the island. So, and particularly not to the island municipalities, right? So of Culebra and Vieques, right, are also just substantially more isolated, right? And so what you know, the concern is that these kind of regional inequalities, these geographic inequalities that already exist in Puerto Rico, are really going to impact how recovery efforts take shape, right? And we're already seeing that with the fact that supplies are not getting very far. Well, they're not getting far because they can't find people to transport supplies and fuel, period. But they're also not getting far outside when they are moving. They're not getting far outside the metropolitan area, right? And so this is a huge concern for people. And the thing that we also have to think about is, with this emphasis on economic growth, and you know, it's likely that, you know, the tourism sector is going to be pushed through this fast recovery because it is one of the bright spots in Puerto Rico's economy, right? And so the desire is going to be to get the tourism sector up and running as fast as possible, which will benefit the San Juan metro area in many ways. And so what we have to think of are those communities that are not in tourist districts or that are very far from tourist districts, what is going to happen to them, right? So what is going to happen to immigrant communities, so Dominican communities in Puerto Rico? What is going to happen to predominantly Black communities, low-income communities, and rural communities in Puerto Rico that are not anywhere near a kind of tourist hotspot, right, or not in these kind of gentrifying neighborhoods of San Juan, right, that they're not the next Bushwick, right? So what is going to happen to those places if post-recovery is urgent? So one of the things that I've been really heartened by and really impressed with has been the diaspora's attention to those inequalities in its fundraising efforts. So one of the things I've been extremely, extremely pleased to see is the massive mobilization to get funds to Taller Salud, which is a feminist public health organization in Loíza, is a phenomenal organization that has been there for, been in Loíza, which is a predominantly Afro-Puerto Rican and low-income community. They've been in that community for decades, and folks have been trying to get funds to them, and because Loíza's lost 3,000 homes. It's estimated 3,000 homes as a result of Maria. And so I think the diaspora is really trying to be attentive to those issues, and I think that that's real because they're left still wondering what's happening to their relatives who are outside of the San Juan area, right? And so I think they're attentive to those kind of inequalities and are trying to figure out in their fundraising efforts, in these kind of brigades that folks are even trying to organize to get materials and vital resources and help rebuilding, how to get those not to the typical places where likely federal funds are already going to land.
Something that you focus a lot on in your own academic research is that one corollary to this colonial development model that has taken root in Puerto Rico has been police repression and incarceration. If you could say a little about what role that plays in Puerto Rican society.
Yeah, I mean, I think I was just having a conversation with a colleague about this yesterday. I think, it's coming out to play in some really fascinating ways post-hurricane. And, I think there's been all of these reports of looting, of people kind of stealing generators, stealing vital necessities from grocery stores or pharmacies. And what we're seeing is even in these kind of moments is this kind of calling for like a military or police crackdown on these kinds of moments. So it's really scary because I think people are just so scared, and the kind of communication that's coming out is it's spotty, right? And so people are hearing certain things. They're not there. A lot of it is kind of worst case scenario kind of information, and so people are like, the National Guard needs to go in there and establish a martial law. We need to send all the military in. They, essentially, people are asking for a kind of military siege to reestablish order. And we've actually seen in Puerto Rico's history. So one of the moments I write about in my own work is the establishment of a anti-crime policy that's called Mano Dura Contra el Crimen, or Iron Fist Against Crime, and which is essentially about sending the National Guard in alongside police into these areas that were identified as kind of crime hotspots, right? And so what we see is that what happens is that the police and National Guard are almost exclusively concentrated in public housing and informal and low-income kind of communities and settlements, right? And so this is something that with these requests to establish order after the hurricane, the historical precedents are there for the kinds of injustice and abuse they are likely to follow. And these expose really long simmering inequalities and prejudices within Puerto Rican society around race and class and spatial location, right? So one of the kind of most troubling things that I've seen was, following reports that a Walgreens in the San Juan area had been robbed, but then also burned once it had kind of been empty. It had been set on fire. the response from folks on social media was immediately one calling for kind of extrajudicial murders of people who were caught, you know, supposedly looting, but then also people saying things like, well, they should go burn down Llorente Torres, which is a large public housing complex that was near where the Walgreens was, because, you know, supposedly, you know, their rationale is like, well, you know, it's those people that did it, right? And so we're seeing these really long-standing forms of race and class inequality that are kind of also going to start reemerging during this moment alongside these larger inequalities that exist between the U.S. and Puerto Rico. So we have to be attentive to both the inequalities that exist within Puerto Rican society between Puerto Ricans, but also between Puerto Rico and the U.S.
And just to underline this, a lot of listeners probably don't know that the Puerto Rican police have a track record of brutality and corruption that's perhaps unparalleled by, you know, would rival that of any of the most abusive departments in the United States.
Right, that's correct. And the DOJ report that came out about the Puerto Rico Police Department a couple of years ago really pointed to what was a systematic suppression of people's political rights, as well as clear race, gender, and class based brutality. So we see particular kind of negligence when it comes to investigating issues of domestic violence, but also violence against LGBT individuals in Puerto Rico. We see a particular targeting of low income and Black communities in Puerto Rico, and we see a particular targeting and desire to chill dissent among left and political groups on the island. So in particular, kind of pro-independence, but also really student groups, university student groups that had been protesting around 2010 and 2011. So we see these kind of, you know, pattern of abuse, right? The police are definitely, you know, there's no reason to think that just because a hurricane happened that suddenly it's a new police force that does not have these systematic kind of concerns. And really the other reality is that Puerto Rico has the largest police force in any U.S. jurisdiction outside of New York City. So we're talking about a force of about 17,000 officers for 3.4 million people, you know? And so the kind of potential for misconduct and kind of social control in this moment on the part of law enforcement is something to really be mindful of, which is, you know, I think hard for people to hear in this moment when they're concerned about a complete lack of the state, right? And so we know that the way that people tend to envision what it means to have the state in their everyday lives is the presence of police, right? They're these kind of ambassadors of the state for many people. They're the most accessible kind of arm of the state, right, in many people's lives. And so I think folks are like not seeing the state at all and are like, well, maybe at least if we see police, they'll do something to help us. But I think we have to be really careful about that.
And it's a sad irony of the prevailing political economy that the neoliberal retrenchment of the social state really abets and justifies the expansion of the carceral state.
Absolutely. I mean, we see this kind of exactly this rollback of the welfare state, right, and this rollout of kind of the punitive arm of the state, right? And that's exactly what, you know, you see in Puerto Rico. So in many ways, Puerto Rico is echoing these trends that are occurring around the world, right? It's really part of, you know, I think we tend to think of Puerto Rico as this like really isolated place, partially because it's a chain of islands, right? But you know, Puerto Rico is really inserted into these global policy trends and plays a role in adapting, but also shaping some of these policy discussions in really interesting ways. And so we have to think about Puerto Rico as experiencing some of these very same patterns of inequality regarding the growth of these punitive structures that we would see in a variety of places, you know, just like New York, like Ferguson, like LA, you know. But also, I think we have to, you know, there are things that are also specific to Puerto Rico within that, although it's echoing larger global trends about kind of how the punitive state is rolling out and affecting people's everyday lives. You know, there are things that are very specific to Puerto Rico's colonial condition in terms of how those particular policies are adapted and who in particular they target under what rationales. And so I think that you know, we're going to see again this collision of kind of colonialism and policing as a tool of establishing social order in Puerto Rico post-hurricane, because that has been typically how the Commonwealth government has been able to govern, right, in the absence of them actually meaningfully being able to shape any kind of political and economic future for the island. One of the ways in which they have been able to shape daily life on the island and establish kind of legitimacy and authority has been through kind of law enforcement.
Before we wrap up, I just want to underline and highlight the colonial context once more. I thought it was really remarkable the other day when Puerto Rico's governor, Ricardo Rossillo, felt compelled to remind other Americans that Puerto Ricans are American citizens. When you think about that, it's just really sort of surreal.
Yeah, so I think the poll said something like more than 50% of the Americans surveyed had no idea that Puerto Ricans were citizens. And I think that's telling about Puerto Rico's kind of weird remaining colonial status, right? I think people are like, what the hell is a Commonwealth, right? It's like, what is Pennsylvania is a Commonwealth, right? So I think people are really confused, right? They're like, what is that, right? And I think they're also confused because it is a racialized place. It is a place that is linguistically and culturally different from the rest of the United States, right? And so, or at least the mainland United States in certain ways, right? And so I think that ignorance about American citizenship comes to light during these moments, right? It came to light, I think, during the debt crisis in really interesting ways, which really promoted this hostility towards any idea of a bailout for Puerto Rico, but is also coming into play around, you know, why do we still have these, like, people? They're nothing but parasites. Like, we should just cut them loose. Why do we need to help them? They got themselves in this mess, right? And so I think that, you know, you're seeing a lot of this kind of reemergence of this way in which there's a hostility and towards Puerto Ricans as American citizens, and really a devaluation of their American citizenship in very overt ways. The thing, though, that is also hard in these moments, right, is that I think Puerto Ricans are trying to make a claim to resources and rights as American citizens, which is really, you know, throwing all non-citizens under the bus in these moments in really troubling ways, right, which is saying that we only deserve recognition and we only deserve protection and resources because we are American citizens. And this has been a source of tension between Puerto Rico and its Latin American and Caribbean neighbors, right, is really the ways in which Puerto Rican citizenship has been used by Puerto Ricans to set themselves apart from these other kind of Latin American and Caribbean countries, right, and talk about kind of the ways in which their kind of seemingly better economic conditions, right, have been tied to American citizenship. But what we keep seeing is that citizenship claim is extremely, extremely, extremely tenuous, right? And that, you know, the kind of benefits of that, you know, that trade-off that Puerto Ricans feel like they're making, right, where, you know, they don't have sovereignty, but at least they have citizenship rights, we're seeing that those kind of rights are there's nowhere near any kind of equality with them, right? So we can talk about also how part of what's causing the delay, right, with hurricane relief packages is that, you know, Puerto Ricans don't have anyone in Congress to kind of advocate. There's no feeling of political accountability, right, to Puerto Rico, right? They can't trade favors on Capitol Hill, right? They don't have any power. So I think that this is, you know, these citizenship questions are really interesting because I think they, you know, perpetuate these kind of inequalities between Puerto Rico and its neighbors, between Puerto Ricans and other Latinos who might not be citizens of the United States, right? So what does it say about kind of the U.S. responsibility to the region in general to anyone else but the U.S. Virgin Islands and Puerto Rico, right? That's kind of what these claims to citizenship do, is say that, you know, all right, well, the U.S. has to help, I guess, help the U.S. Virgin Islands and Puerto Rico, but it doesn't need to worry about trying to help rebuild Dominica or any of the other kind of countries that have been just devastated by the passage of Irma and Maria. So I think, you know, it's a troubling kind of effect that comes out of this need for Puerto Ricans to just constantly reassert their citizenship, because it gets used in these problematic ways to say, all right, well, I guess if we owe these people something because they're citizens, we don't need to deal with these other people then.
Marisol Lebrón, thank you so much. And I wish you and your family the best.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Marisol Lebrón is a professor of American Studies at Dickinson College. And now, on to Brandi Jensen. Brandi Jensen, welcome to The Dig.
Thank you for having me.
So to start, I'm curious whether you were an IRL funny person before you found Twitter.
I mean, that's sort of an odd question to answer, to like evaluate your own funniness. I crack myself up regularly. I don't know if that counts. I'm one of those really like insufferable people who laughs at my own jokes. No, I mean, I've never been like a comedian, but I guess I just found Twitter and sort of took to it quickly. I mean, I've always had like a profoundly dark sense of humor, so that tends to help on Twitter. But no, I was just a normal person. I actually joined Twitter because I was working for this terrible self-publishing company, and I got this like bullshit job being the content manager, which like is one of those titles that means absolutely nothing. But they wanted me to run the Twitter, and I had never been on Twitter before, so I joined just to like figure it out for work in 2015. And just sort of liked it a lot and had a lot of spare time. I was living in Minnesota at the time, and there wasn't all that much to do. So, I mean, my brain was already broken in ways that allowed me to figure out Twitter pretty quickly. And then, you know, it's managed to both materially improve my life and radically darken my soul.
And the upshot is now you never have to fix your brain. It's good to go.
I've found my people.
I want to talk to you about some of the recent horribleness, which there's plenty of, and
you're gonna have to be more specific, I think.
run it through your incisive analytical machine. The last week has been consumed by Trump's attack on NFL players kneeling in protests of police brutality. What do you think Trump is trying to do here, if it's not going too far to attribute that kind of strategic thinking to him?
Well, I mean, I think it probably is going a little too far to attribute that kind of strategic thinking. I don't know that he's trying to do anything besides assert himself, assert dominance in whatever like bullshit ways that he does. You'll often get these cries of like, oh, this is a distraction, and you know, functionally maybe it is, but he's not a smart man. He's not a strategic thinker. You know, I think he's driven solely by like base instincts. And so he, you know, this is what he does. He lashes out in these, you know, profoundly stupid and cruel ways.
Yeah, he's probably not a strategic thinker, but he can read a crowd. And he was right, I guess, to know that that crowd of old white people in Alabama was very pleased to have Trump saying that he would put these unruly black athletes in their place.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, he came within a hair's breadth of calling them uppity, you know. I mean, this is essentially what he does, is that, you know, he taps into everything vile and cruel about America, and he does it in these ways that are interesting, because, you know, he's tacked this to this broad sense of patriotism. And I mean, I would challenge anybody to ask Trump to recite the national anthem unprompted, and I would be very surprised if he could do it. He's not, you know, he's not a patriotic man. Not that that word means much of anything, but yeah, he does. I mean,
especially coming from a Canadian like you, Brandi Jensen.
Well, that has been, yeah, there are a lot of odd things about being an expat, a foreigner in the States. I mean, healthcare makes no sense to me on any level, and gun culture. But the weirdest thing is this, like, flag-fucking patriotism. It just is embarrassing, and I think is, you know, patriotism is rightly viewed with a healthy sense of suspicion in Canada and other countries. It's weird, man. It's fucking weird to love your country that much.
Well, yeah, it's like all the American flags, as though when you get lost going down some cul-de-sac, you're going to forget what country you were in. And you're like, oh, thanks for the reminder. I'm in the USA.
Yeah, it's, I mean, it's an odd... America's understanding of itself is fascinating, and, you know, all kinds of fucked up. And in some ways, I mean, I don't know that Trump understands that on any sort of intellectual level, but he's certainly tapping into that.
You mentioned American gun culture, which oddly, or maybe actually predictably enough, does intersect with this NFL debate, because the NRA came out with this advertising touting themselves as the leading defender of the flag and the military against all those who would disrespect it.
For the land of the free and the home of the brave. From high school gyms to towering stadiums, every time I see our flag wave, I feel a humbling reminder of the brave who keep and have kept us free. I stand to honor the sacrifices of the generations before me. Heroes who charged into battle through bombs and bullets, who lost their brothers and still pushed through, fighting for every inch of our freedom.
It's just clearer than ever that the NRA is not only hostile to any sort of gun control, but has positioned itself as this powerful force for the most right-wing elements in American society, really, like, across the board.
Yeah, I mean, they also didn't, like, Dana Loesch, I think, had that, like, batshit video a few months ago, just talking about, like, protesters generally. And I think there was some indication.
Oh, it was really dystopian. Yeah.
Protesters. Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, it's something that would fit in, you know, like a Verhoeven movie. my ability to discern, reality from, you know, what would actually work very well as a weird Twitter joke. You know, that's been one of the stranger things to experience, is that, you know, everything that would have done well as, like, a joke on weird Twitter 2 years ago is now, like, made manifest. And it's fucking bizarre to be looking at people like Dan O'Sullivan and Matt Chrisman as, like, these odd prophets of our new dystopian reality.
Weird Twitter precog.
Yes. Yeah, this is definitely, you know, that's definitely darkest timeline.
As liberals like to say, you know, this is not normal. Obviously, in some ways, Trump is obviously not normal. But in some ways, this is yet another example, I think, of the ways in which he's at least an
outgrowth, really fundamentally, of very normal things. The Department of Defense under Obama paid tens of millions of dollars to professional sports teams to promote kind of militarist patriotism. Given that, it's sort of not surprising that it ultimately became this very extremist right-wing cudgel to attack black players with.
The sort of confluence of militarism, this kind of like dick swinging, you know, masculinized idea of patriotism is certainly nothing new. And yeah, this idea that Trump is like, you know, an aberration from the Republican Party, like, to my mind, that is the biggest mistake that the Clinton campaign made, and that in some ways Dems continue to make, is that, you know, they refuse to yoke Trump to like the conservative movement as a whole, right? And that, you know, he's not some sort of odd aberration of conservative values. Like he's just the most unsubtle realization of them.
Yeah. And I mean, it was the post 9/11 Department of Defense under Obama that spent all of this money to promote the idea that football is patriotism, is supporting the troops. So yeah, Trump takes it to like another level, but on so many of these issues, it was an opportunity that was created by the purportedly normal people who preceded him.
Yeah, I mean, the context is there, right? I mean, you can't, you know, you sort of all of the elements were in place for a situation like this to be taken advantage of, and they weren't put in place in the last 6 months. You know, this is sort of a longstanding environment that had been created that Trump is just able to take advantage of. And again, these really like unsubtle, boorish, you know, Trumpian ways that he does.
My last question on this is where you see the state of the kind of analysis and popular debate over it right now, which is obviously the widespread showing of solidarity across the NFL on Sunday was a good thing, but it also reflects that Trump has been able to turn the discussion into like another piece of his reality TV show, instead of something about the underlying issue that prompted Colin Kaepernick to kneel in the first place, which is a protest against police brutality.
I mean, I'm not going to be able to say probably anything smarter than David Roth. I wrote a great piece for The Baffler about this, you know, talking about how this civic tic that we've developed, which is that, you know, we feel like we have to broadly respond in some way to everything that Trump does. But what that ends up doing is like hollowing out what were very specific and directed criticisms into this, you know, Trump is bad kind of idea that, you know, barely counts as protest at all. And you see that happening in a few other arenas, right? That what became a specific critique that had, you know, legitimate and discrete goals ends up getting kind of flattened into something that you can, you know, call the hashtag resistance, right? And so that's sort of the biggest concern. And, you know, like, I'll be very honest, sports is not like my particular area of expertise, but you do see this happening in certain ways in the feminist movement as well, that, you know, what are specific critiques of various policy goals end up kind of being flattened into something, you know, nebulous and vague as, you know, a bunch of women in pussy hats, or, you know, whatever the case may be. So the exhausting thing to think about is that this is just going to keep happening in ways that I don't even know if Trump is going to be smart enough to sort of catch on to this, but he's probably just going to like stumble ass backwards into it, is that any kind of debate that he weighs in on then becomes a way to like broadly, but really kind of toothlessly oppose Trump. I understand that you can't ignore what he's saying. You know, that's not really like a viable approach, but the kneeling started under Obama, you know, wasn't a Trump protest, and that it has become one. I mean, I guess kind of like, it kind of feels good, but we often mistake what feels good with politics. And these two aren't the same things.
Yeah, because it sort of it feels good, I think, to some people, because it maybe smooths the sharper radical edge of the initial protest, and that more radical edge is an indictment of a system of mass incarceration and police brutality that's been perpetuated under governments of both major parties.
Yeah, precisely.
Consistently.
Yeah, I mean, you know, when you've got NFL owners, ostensibly partaking in this protest, like, I'm not really sure that it has the same kind of coherence at that point.
Yeah, and those are, like, truly some of the worst human beings in the United
yeah,
States.
Yeah, exactly.
The question about how this stuff all gets sort of always, like, sucked up and appropriated by the Trump show is an interesting one, because it's not, I mean, again, like, Trump's not this great strategist, so he does have obviously some, like, skills at reading, like, pretty precisely what his base wants to hear, I think. But he's no great strategist. I don't think that everything becoming this Trump show has served him well. You know, he's failed over and over again at a lot of what he said that he wanted to accomplish. But I also don't think it serves building a alternative to Trump very well.
Well, it ends up, I mean, it just sucks up a lot of oxygen, right? When you're sort of constantly in this, like, defensive position, it's hard to devote, like, just even intellectual and emotional resources towards, you know, constructing some sort of, like, competing vision of the future, right? I think it's really important to keep an eye on, like, what happens after this, you know? And that's always been the complaint about the Democrats as this sort of the party of resistance. I'm certainly not the first one to point this out, that they, you know, being anti-Trump is not enough. But yeah, that's, again, you know, it's understandable, because he is, like, this is, it's an objectively insane political moment, and so one feels kind of unsure what to do about it. But obviously, you know, it's important to devote some resources to like a leftist political imagination, right? And one of the, I mean, you know, I don't want to say that there's, like, any benefits to Trump, because this is, you know, everything's fucking awful. But I think the one thing that, you know, that his moment and this continuing moment says is, you know, fuck what you thought was possible. You know, Donald fucking Trump is president. Like, you can't schoolmarm me into telling me what is possible. There's a potential there for, okay, if this is possible, then, you know, pretty much what all of the, you know, the politics thinkers told you could happen in the country is, you know, on some level a load of bullshit. So let's reorient and let's start thinking about impossible things.
Yeah, the politics as we know it being blown up, it's not about whether, you know, we're saying Trump, there's, like, a potentially good side of Trump. It's just, like, a fact that politics has been blown up, and it's incumbent on the left to appraise the situation and figure out the best way to move forward.
Well, and to exercise, you know, a much more expansive political imagination, right? That we are not constrained by common sense or reality as we may have understood it 2 years ago. Like, we just aren't. Donald fucking Trump is president, you know? That's like an effective rejoinder to a lot of, you know, single payer isn't possible in this country. Bitch, Donald Trump is president. Like, don't tell me what's possible in this country.
Speaking of people who are unconstrained by wisdom, conventional or otherwise, in a different way, I want to turn to Roy Moore.
Who is also this, like, just insane cartoon villain of a person.
And thus, like, a pretty fitting icon for the Republican Party circa 2017.
Yeah, exactly. And they're all going to fall. They're all going to fall in line behind him, right? Like, this is, you know, again, one of these examples of, okay, this is not, you know, Donald Trump himself was not, like, just a singular aberration when it comes to the Republican Party. It's, you know, it's the outgrowths are everywhere. You know, the interesting thing about our current political moment is that Everybody's so attuned to politics all the time that, you know, every week you get to learn of some new, just batshit insane person running somewhere. But yeah, I mean, you could, you know, there, I think there's a real opportunity to force the GOP broadly to say, like, yes, we, you know, these are the people that are our party now, and we support their policies. We also, you know, we're fine with this guy who thinks God did 9/11.
What do you think it portends for the internal politics of the Republican Party? Does this mean that the process of civil war and cannibalization that launched with the Tea Party is only going to get crazier?
I mean, I don't know. I'm not, you know, I'm not in the prophecy business. I'm not one of those who has any sort of faith in the idea of, you know, a moderate or an upstanding Republican. That's a fucking unicorn. They don't exist. I think there are pretty good examples in the smaller scale of how, you know, our you know, maybe 80s or 90s understanding of, like, you know, business Republicans just end up getting the shit kicked out of them by this, like, more fringe element of the party. I mean, as from what I understand, that's essentially, like, what's been happening in Texas and a few other places. So, yeah, I mean, anybody who's waiting for, you know, moderate right-thinking Republicans to save the party from itself, I think is going to be waiting a long fucking time.
Yeah, I mean, the business establishment that people like Roy Moore are taking down, that business establishment is a Frankenstein that's created and relied on these monsters for all of these years, and now they're getting eaten alive by them. It's not surprising.
They're getting eaten alive by them, but I mean, for the most part, like, as long as the GOP is willing to sort of redistribute wealth upwards, they will abide any of this. You know, they will be fine with this, like, fucking weirdo dude riding a horse to the polling station and trying to make being gay illegal. They don't care as long as they get their tax cuts. So there's, you know, nobody's coming in to save the Republicans from themselves. We just have to destroy them on every level.
Fun fact before I let you go, the Senator Luther Strange, who Roy Moore defeated, my mother's family's
great,
amazing name,
fantastic,
right?
Fantastic name. Can we just for a moment appreciate the name and the fact that this dude is like 7 feet tall? I mean, again, weird Twitter jokes made flesh.
Yeah, straight out of Birmingham.
But you have a story
about
yes, it, right?
My mom's from Birmingham, and when she was young, my aunt dated Luther Strange.
No.
Yes. And according to my mom, my grandfather would call him Strange Luther.
Oh, get your grandpa on Twitter.
Yeah. Well, R.I.P. I don't think he would do it if he was around, but yeah, it's not quite as good as the guy who was college roommates with Ted Cruz and snitched on him jacking off, but pretty good.
Oh God, can we not? I really don't.
Sorry.
Although I will say, Ted Cruz liking a porn tweet was objectively the best thing that's happened maybe since the inauguration. That was like a reminder that things can be fun and we can all come together in like the shared occupation of dunking on Ted Cruz. That, you know what, that's a vision for the left. That's what solidarity feels like. You know, when you all come together for common cause, and that common cause is dunking on somebody as objectively fucking awful as Ted Cruz.
We've got to take our respite where we can find it. Brandi Jensen,
exactly.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Brandi Jensen lives in Brooklyn with her dog. She tweets too much, but The Baffler pays her to do it. Thank you for listening to The Dig from Jacobin Magazine. As Marx once was overheard saying, while other podcasts have only interpreted the world in various ways, our point is to change it. We are posting new episodes every week, usually twice a week. The Dig was produced by Alex Lewis, music by Jeffrey Brodsky. Our Postmaster General is Christian Tyler. Follow us on Twitter at The Dig Radio, and please find us wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe. And if it's on iTunes, leave us a review. Those reviews not only feed the corporate Borg over at Apple, but also help introduce us to new listeners. What also helps introduce us to new listeners is for you to tell your friends to take a listen. All propaganda on our behalf is greatly appreciated. And please, last but certainly not least, find us on patreon.com/thedig and make a contribution. We need your help to keep this thing going.